This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. This hour we're talking energy and what the world's energy future might be like. And we're talking about it because there's a massive energy bill that is being debated in the U.S. Senate this week. And this comes almost 2 years after President Bush announced that an energy policy would be a major focus of his administration. The House of Representatives has already passed an energy bill of its own. The Senate version contains a little bit of everything. There are some things that are expected, some things that are surprising. There's a call for the production of thousands of fuel cell cars, which is probably not unexpected. But there's also an incentive to reinvigorate the nuclear power industry. Now, no nuclear power plants have been built since the accident at Three Mile Island in 1979. But the Senate bill plans to encourage nuclear power by offering loan money for the construction of new advanced nuclear power plants. As for efforts to cut off the flow of foreign oil into this country, there is a requirement that the nation cut oil use by 1 million barrels a day in the next 10 years. But there is no details in the bill on how to do that. There's a controversial plan to study the fossil fuel reserves off the nation's coasts, with the possibility of drilling off of Florida and Louisiana shorelines. That's really, as I say, very controversial. So this hour we'll be talking about the development of a national energy policy, what's in the current bills, what do you think should be in there, and then later on in the hour, Jeremy Rifkin will join us to talk about how Europe may be leading the way toward the energy of the future, hydrogen. And there's been some bad news reported about hydrogen and the environment this week. So stay with us. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. If you want to talk about the energy policy, let me introduce my guest. Dr. Daniel M. Kamen is a professor in the Goldman School of Public Policy and a professor of nuclear engineering and director of the Renewable and Appropriate Energy Laboratory at the University of California at Berkeley. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks very much.
You're welcome. Stephen Nadel is Executive Director of the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy, or ACEEE, I guess you would say, in Washington, D.C. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
We heard in the newscast a little interesting news blip about the state of California is going to limit the use of SUVs in its fleets out there. Does it look like the states are going to be pushing the country more than the federal government? Let me ask you, Dr. Kamen.
Well, it certainly seems that way. I mean, California in the last year has done a series of, I think, very important measures, and this SUV one is clearly there because the federal government hasn't acted. In the past year, California passed the Renewable Energy Portfolio Standard, which many people, including myself, think should be the center point of a clean energy policy, and also agreed to set standards up so that we will actually be the first place in the world to reduce CO2 emissions from vehicles by 2007. This new one on SUVs is critically important because oil has really got to be one of the critical aspects along with energy efficiency in a real energy policy, not the current mush.
Well, let's talk about this mush, is the energy policy that we have. How is the new energy bill going to get us out of the mush?
Well, I don't think it will, actually. I really think that this particular bill is, as you said in the intro, a real grab bag of people's favorite items here and there. The nuclear one is a very interesting and going to be very controversial change, and I think the most interesting single item for me is the call now for 1 million barrels of oil reduction, although unfortunately it is by 2010, and I believe we have the technology and the economic incentive to do it far sooner than that.
Does it say how to get to that a million barrel reduction?
It doesn't say specifically, but legislation of this type, of setting up an important standard that's a little ways off and then letting people work through it, I think is one of the better mechanisms we have. For example, California passed many years ago the so-called ZEV standard, the Zero Emission Vehicle Standard, and that was the same thing. The state said we want to increase the number of vehicles on the roads that produce very little emissions, and we will now give, in this case, the California Air Resources Board, our state body to do it. We'll give them 7 years to work it through and deal with the lawsuits from the auto industry, et cetera. Well, a direct result of the California ZEV mandate are the hybrid vehicles we see on the roads and dramatically reduced emissions from conventional vehicles, the internal combustion engine vehicles. So I actually like the pattern. I think we don't need to wait until 2010 for the million barrels a day, but you have to credit Mary Landrieu, Senator from Louisiana, and others for bringing this up and getting it through on a 99-1 vote in the Senate.
Wow. Stephen Nadel, what's your take on
I agree that this will be helpful, this Landreau provision. It's short on specifics. There's no enforcement. It asks the White House to basically propose a plan in 1 year. But a million barrels per day would be very helpful. We can easily save that. We can actually save quite a bit more and reduce our dependence on oil imports, which is unfortunately rising now.
Could we really do that with just a little bit more energy efficiency or fuel efficiency almost overnight?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's striking right now how many different options are available that are not being used. I mean, for example, at the current time, off-the-shelf technologies, there could be four-valve cylinders in vehicles, which Toyota and Honda already have. We could have hybrid vehicles with sort of a 50% increase in efficiency for the vehicles. We could have automatic shut-off for engines and stop signs and cylinder idling when you're at highway speeds. You could add gears and better tires. We could move our truly moribund efficiency of our vehicles, the CAFE standard, so-called, up to doubling it, I believe, 40 miles to the gallon or more, saving that energy right off. And in fact, at the same time, the U.S. has transferred over $1 trillion to oil-producing countries over the past 30 years. And so the savings from doing these things would be immediate.
Stephen Adel?
Yeah, I agree. We can increase fuel economy enormously. We've done some work showing that you can get a 40-mile-per-gallon pickup truck or SUV even if we just apply some of these advanced technologies.
But the administration chose not to do that, but instead, a while back, chose to emphasize putting money into fuel cells and cars.
Well, this is a funny one for me because I'm a big supporter of hydrogen, and we should talk later on about, I think, the very inaccurate article in Science you mentioned about the environmental issues of hydrogen. But the administration's Freedom Car Plan is basically one that says, do research for the next 5 or 6 years on hydrogen and fuel cell vehicles and report back to us, and we'll see if we want to do more after spending almost $760 million a year in the process. Well, there's an alternative bill out there that Senators Cox and Wyden proposed that actually does what I think you should do. It says we'll do research on hydrogen, but in the process we're going to increase the markets for hybrid vehicles. We're going to try to get Detroit to catch up with the rest of the world, and we'll build markets for clean vehicles instead of waiting 7 years for things that I think Steve and I both sort of said are off the shelf today.
Mm-hmm. Yep, we really need to concentrate on things we can do in the shorter term while we're working on fuel cells, which hopefully will be very promising post-2020.
Since you brought it up, Dan, about the research paper out this week showing that if we go to a hydrogen economy, there might be enough release of hydrogen up in the atmosphere to create more moisture, which would possibly deplete the ozone layer. What you say that's flawed research?
Yeah, I'm actually a little startled that this paper came out. I mean, they're very good chemists, but to be honest, the policy side of this work, and this is really a policy argument based on science, is really strange. I'm still confused as to how it got through the science review process, which I
you think it's that bad?
Respect. I think it is. I mean, for example, let me just lead off a couple of the items in it. The chemistry analysis of the atmosphere in their paper is quite good, but they assume that the amount of hydrogen that will leak out of our infrastructure, out of pipes and vehicles and things, is roughly 20% of all the hydrogen we use. That's based on a study of international leakage, often from natural gas pipelines, many of which are very old and decaying in parts of Russia and Central Asia. Well, the leakage from hydrogen in our system today is under 2%. So right off, there's an order of magnitude, I would argue they're wrong. The next feature is they assume that 100% of our current gasoline economy is converted to fuel cells. Well, most people believe that the fuel cell market will do good to capture 30%. So there's another factor of three right there. Mm-hmm. And then I think the most troubling is, and they say in their paper, that if in fact we get this hydrogen economy by, say, 2040 or 2050, then their argument is no longer valid, because the main issue is that the ozone holes right now are currently repairing themselves. If we had a full-blown hydrogen economy by 2020 and all of their previous incorrect assumptions were true, then you might have an issue. But I don't believe that we are going to see hydrogen as the dominant energy supply that soon, and I think that the other aspects I mentioned where the analysis is just off base. It's really unfortunate that this got through the review process, not in terms of the science, but in terms of the policy.
Let me ask you, because you are a professor of nuclear engineering, what about this really novel approach to resurrecting the nuclear power industry?
Well, this is really fascinating. I mean, I wouldn't quite say it's novel, because the nuclear industry has received very significant subsidies in the past, and this is another one. What I'm surprised about is both how rapidly this came up and the degree of the size of the subsidy. What it is a up to $16 billion loan guarantee for the nuclear industry. And that's been the critical bugaboo for the industry for quite a while, in that no company was willing to build that first new power plant, even though the administration and the Department of Energy has done everything they can to so-called streamline the licensing process. Even with that, no one's wanted to take the first step, because the first person to or company to license a new plant is the guinea pig, and they didn't want to then do all the work and have other companies capture the rewards. This $16 billion is likely to generate around 8 new nuclear power plants being aggressively pursued by companies, because now there's an incentive to be the first company to license, not the last. In fact, I testified on nuclear power 2 days ago in front of the House, and there's a real buzz about this issue right now.
Yeah, well, how do you get around the people's fear of not in my own backyard and the safety issues and things like that? I mean, it seems odd that you can argue with one time that you're for renewable energy sources, yet now you're also arguing we need nuclear.
Oh, I don't think I was arguing that. I'm very interested in nuclear technology. I don't personally believe that nuclear is needed today, given the economics. I believe if you do the full accounting of the cost of Yucca Mountain, the risk issues, that we do not necessarily need it. I think that Steve's work on energy efficiency tells us that the first thing we need to do is to really take advantage of the efficiency measures that are out there. And by efficiency, I mean environmentally they're better, because we reduce the amount of pollution. And from a business perspective, why produce energy that we don't need if we used it wisely? But to stick with the nuclear point, because there has been a lot of interest in this regrowing the industry, nuclear power plants have become dramatically more efficient and safer over the last 20 years. I am nowhere near as sanguine about our ability to process and handle the waste. And I believe that thinking about nuclear power plants without the full waste cycle is doing ourselves a big disservice. And so while I'm very interested to see nuclear improve itself, I don't believe they are ready at this stage, nor do I believe that this scale, $16 billion of loan guarantee subsidies, is the necessary first step in this process.
Steven, any comment?
A couple of comments. I mean, I agree that energy efficiency has enormous opportunities here. We calculate that we can cost effectively in this country reduce energy use by more than 30%. That's a lot more than nuclear power now provides or can realistically provide in any medium, even somewhat long-term scenario. So there's a lot more efficiency. It's much less expensive, much cleaner. I'd also point out that what primarily killed nuclear power was Wall Street. It just got too expensive, and people didn't want to invest in it. So they still have to solve that problem, how they're going to make it cost-effective.
Well, did insurance companies not want to insure them also?
Well, I think that's actually a feature which is probably fixed for the industry perspective, because not only will there be this large loan guarantee subsidy, but the nuclear industry also benefits from the so-called Price-Anderson subsidy, which is almost incalculable in terms of its economic value, and it says that a nuclear plant operator is capped in their liability at a fairly low level, I would argue, in terms of if there was an accident. So I would say this is the biggest set of green lights for nuclear I have seen in a long time.
Steve, do you have something else to say before I
not on nuclear now.
All right, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, talk lots more about nuclear power, so stay with us, and other alternative energies and energy stuff that's in the bill. Anything you want to talk about, we'll get to your call, so stay with us. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow, and we're talking this hour about energy policy with my guest, Stephen Nadel, Executive Director of the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy, and Dr. Daniel Kamen, Director of the Renewable and Appropriate Energy Laboratory, University of California at Berkeley. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let's see if we can get to a phone call or two. Let's go to Ed in La Jolla. Hi, Ed.
Yes, hi. This is not a question per se, and since there are four of us, we almost have a minion, which Ira can explain what that means. I'm one of the five fathers of the hydrogen economy. The others were George Ahlefeld from Munich, who died, probably the best practical experts, Louis Schlappach at University of Freiburg. There was a fellow named George Leibowitz at Allied Signal I haven't heard in a long time. I ran the first hydrogen fuel cell. But my background is interesting because while I was doing that, I was chief metallurgist at TSE&G building Salem 1 and 2, fired by them in 1976. There's an article about me, which anyone can look up. It's in the Village Voice, page 41, August 21st.
Ed, you got to give Ed, you have to give us a question.
Okay.
Pedigree's not good enough.
Question. It's a comment. I just was at the American Nuclear Society meeting out here in San Diego, and I heard about nuclear-produced hydrogen. Two problems with it. Three problems. Number one, nuclear is dangerous. Read the article about me. I'm a well-known whistleblower from Westinghouse and then PSE&G and then the IAEA. The superalloys in nuclear plants, stainless steels and nickel-based superalloys, are what's called Stuckdreck, which I reckon translate for the audience. It means they're garbage. This is major fraud. There's an art. There's a book everyone.
So you're saying that if we go back to a nuclear power, that's a bad thing?
Yeah, there's a book everyone should read called Nuclear Power from Physics to Politics by Lawrence Pringle, published in 1979, and he's in the tone book in West Nyack, New York. A superb book about how it metamorphosed from science to technology to politics. Now, just let me continue.
No, I haven't got a whole Ed Siegel.
Back to hydrogen. All right, there are three things wrong. Nuclear is wrong. Renewables is right. Second, hydrogen. Very nice if it escapes. We know about this problem because I also worked at Ford and General Motors. Number three, what do you want to make with hydrogen? Using hydrogen to power automobiles is ridiculous. Just as an aside, there's a guy named Jim Burns at San Diego State who has a fleet of 80-mile-per-gallon hybrid vehicles going around San Diego here. What's the most valuable thing in the world, including even your health? Water. I'm sure you've done shows on this, Ira, the book by Paul Simon.
Ed, right. Thanks for calling. All right. What's your reactions? Stephen, any reaction to Ed Siegel there?
I'm not really an expert on hydrogen or nuclear, so I'll defer.
All right.
Okay, well, I actually work on hydrogen, and trying to wrap around what he was going there was pretty tough. But let me just do a couple of the points. There are several things going on with nuclear and hydrogen that are issues. One thing in the bill, for example, is that a new test reactor will be authorized under the Senate version of the bill that is going to be a small reactor to be built in Idaho at one of the national labs, the Idaho National Engineering and Environmental Laboratory. And that's a reactor designed to test out some of the issues about hydrogen produced from nuclear. And I agree, there are a number of issues about that. The most basic one is that the temperature that the reactors we think about today operate at is not the optimal one for the production of hydrogen. Hydrogen needs to be at a hotter temperature to do it. And so there's some real concerns, and in fact, my testimony in front of the House on Tuesday was really about this, because I'm very concerned that the capacity, i.e. the number of different top-ranked nuclear researchers in the United States working on hydrogen is very low. There's one absolutely brilliant individual at Oak Ridge Labs, but it is not a field that we have invested enough in to answer a lot of the questions yet. So I would like to see a little more research before we...
Are other countries doing better research or more intense research than we are on this?
There are. There's some impressive hydrogen work going on in France and in Scandinavia, but it's not... It is not the immediate issue for a lot of these nuclear areas because they've been trying to preserve their current reactors as the number one priority. So there's a lot to be done if we want to take this route, and I suspect we're jumping the gun a little bit here.
Let's talk about the energy bill now in Congress a little bit more. Are there any energy efficiency provisions in there for individuals, for corporations?
Yeah, there's a number of provisions, two of which are fairly significant. One, there's a series of tax credits for advanced energy-saving technologies, more efficient heating and cooling equipment, appliances, combined heat and power systems. even vehicles, fuel cell vehicles, but also hybrid vehicles in the Senate bill, which we think is very good because the hybrid vehicles are here and now and not something for the future. The other big provision is minimum efficiency standards, meaning a requirement that certain products achieve a certain level of efficiency for a variety of commercial as well as residential equipment. These essentially get rid of the worst equipment and let consumers and businesses choose between, you know, fairly efficient and very efficient equipment. So those two provisions are significant. On the other hand, the bill's missing a lot. We talked before about the automobile fuel economy standards. There's also a few other things that are missing as well.
Such as?
They really don't do anything about energy efficiency in the utility sector, be it electric utilities or gas utilities. There's a lot that these utilities can do to help encourage their customers to reduce energy use. In California in 2001, the utilities in the state really actively promoted energy efficiency. They reduced energy use by more than 6% that year. But the bill, while it largely deregulates the electric industry, really doesn't do anything to promote energy efficiency as part of it, and that's a real big mistake. They could reduce electricity use by 1% a year with proper provisions, and they could also do a lot more for natural gas. With natural gas prices going up, they should get the gas utilities much more involved.
That's right. It's a real, I mean, another thing I would add to that list is that we now know a great deal about getting appliances so they use dramatically less power in a whole variety of modes, including the so-called standby mode or vampire power when they're not doing anything but they're waiting for you to talk with them by remotes and things. And we could get companies through a whole variety of measures to dramatically decrease the power of all the things that are you buy and have around your home. And it's a shame we're not doing more on those areas, which I think are also critical for this overall process of simply using less energy when we don't need it and having it available for things that we do need.
Yeah.
There are power companies that are not doing, if not experimental, practical tests of hooking up your appliances to the internet and then getting credit for when you run your dishwasher or your clothes dryer at nighttime when there's less of a demand and giving you a cheaper rate. Any incentives for that kind of stuff in there?
There are tax incentives in the bill for special meters that allow them to more efficiently do these types of programs. So there's some small incentives, but nothing dramatic.
What about it? What about renewable energy sources? There was some flap this week about gasohol using ethanol in cars.
Well, there's a couple things on that one. I mean, one funny one that needs to be fixed in this bill, and I certainly hope it will done, is this is the so-called E85 standard. And this says that vehicles produced that could potentially use ethanol are going to receive the credit for having actually used ethanol. Even if they don't use it. Now, that's an obvious thing to fix, and people are talking about it, but it may slip through undone. I hope not.
Right. Senator Harkin is working on an amendment that hopefully will be accepted.
And we're hoping that will get in, but that's a kind of egregious one. Mm-hmm. But on the renewables front, we now have electricity from wind, which is cheaper than many of the fossil fuel alternatives, and yet wind and solar and biomass operate under some real constraints. It's very difficult for them to hook into the grid because their local utilities make it a deal where they essentially have to jump through more hoops than anyone else around. Getting those sorts of standards so they were more even across the board, which is not in this bill in a significant way, would do wonders not only for building these markets, but just simply for increasing our energy security by producing more energy domestically. I always like to say that we should be energy farmers, not energy hunter-gatherers.
Well, I've been told over and over again by people who work for the federal government who do research on wind energy that there's enough energy in wind in, let's say, North and South Dakota to power 40% of all the electricity that we have in the country.
That's right.
But there's no way to get it to the country because the grid doesn't run through there.
Well, not really. I mean, that's two things. Germany went from basically no wind capacity to having three times our wind capacity in a very short time. Now, Germany has less wind resource than North Dakota does. When people talk about not being able to get the wind to the users, that's really a feature of we need to build some additional power lines, not just for wind, but because the U.S. system has increased so dramatically over the past few years that our infrastructure is very much behind the times.
But to me, that says that's the kind of thing that would make sense in a national energy bill to create that infrastructure looking toward the future.
Right, and that's why I said in the beginning that my real concern here is that this is not an energy policy. This is a grab bag of measures that are supported by various individuals. And the real, at least promise on paper that was, we were supposed to get through a national energy policy process that, that President Cheney's laid out has not taken place. We're not looking at the critical issues like building up renewables for a diverse energy supply, like building that infrastructure, and critically by rewarding energy efficiency, which are all things we should begin with and are being left aside in terms of in favor of politics.
Right, this bill is a small down payment in compared to what we really need. They're doing a few things where they can get some political consensus, and anything that's controversial, they're just punting on until sometime in the future when we have more of a crisis and we really have to do it, as opposed to planning ahead a bit more and doing it in a more gradual and systematic manner.
Mm-hmm. And doing it, therefore, at less cost.
Exactly.
1-800-989-8255. Michael in Baltimore. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. Thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead.
I want to talk a little bit about fuel efficiency, both gasoline and diesel, because I'm a truck driver.
Mm-hmm.
I got to borrow a line from the TV show The West Wing. I think a lot of politicians, when they talk about CAFE standards and improving fuel efficiency and whatnot, are publicly for, but privately against that. And the reason I say that is if CAFE standards are raised and cars start getting 20, 30, 40, 50 miles to the gallon, and big trucks are put on the rails, there is a tremendous loss in gasoline and diesel fuel tax revenues to the states and the federal government. And they would have to find some way to make up those hundreds of millions, maybe even billions of dollars that would be lost in those revenues, and that would be politically unpopular, to say the least. But if I take my big truck and put it on the rail from here to California...
What do you mean, put it on the rail?
If I take my trailer and put it on a train,
right,
and ship it from Baltimore to California, all those states in the middle don't get the diesel fuel tax that they would normally get for, and the highway use tax for, that they would normally get for me going across their state. And they lose that revenue. And this is billions of dollars a year.
Mm-hmm.
And the same with automobiles. If my Ford Escort, which now gets 30 miles to the gallon, doubles to 60, I buy half the gas and pay half the fuel tax to the federal government and to the states. And I don't think that the politicians really want to find... It's going to be really hard for them to make up that shortfall in revenue without looking bad politically, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, let me get Stephen Nadel. Any comment on that?
I would say they don't seem to care that much, at least here in Washington, about how much revenue they lose. They've just passed in more than $1 trillion worth of tax cuts and aren't worried about how they're going to pay for resulting government services. I agree, yes, there would be a hit, but compared to the cuts that they've made, I don't think they'd be that concerned. I think the reason they haven't done it is they buy the line from the auto industry, oh, gee, this would cause safety problems, or gee, it would take away pickup trucks from farmers. Those are not true. You can build the efficient cars and trucks much more safely, have a efficient pickup truck, but these arguments are allowed to hold sway.
I think Michael's also concerned with the state taxes every gallon of gas or diesel fuel.
That's right. And yeah. I think he's on the right track here, because I do think this is an example of the degree to which energy, you have to think about how deeply embedded it is in our infrastructure, and people profit up and down the line, which has really been one of the biggest impediments to these sorts of innovations. People have known for years that we could build cars that get over 100 miles to the gallon, and yet we don't get that for a whole variety of reasons that really do relate to who benefits and who loses in the short term, as opposed to how much the country loses by not taking this route.
Michael, thanks for calling.
Thanks, Ira.
Good luck to you.
Thank you.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. We're talking about the new energy bills in Congress this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Talking with Steve Nadel, Executive Director of the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy, and Daniel Kamen at the University of Berkeley, California at Berkeley. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. If you could, and I, you know, do the magic wand question, so a lot of my guests, if you had a magic wand and you could change the energy bill and put stuff in it or create something more cohesive, what would it look like? Let me ask each one of you. Dr. Cameron?
Well, I would start off by basically adopting the set of energy efficiency measures, rewarding efficient use of energy and penalizing inefficient use that Steve and others have talked about. That's the number one. You want to use what you have more efficiently. And then I would institute a national renewable energy policy standard, meaning a portfolio standard, meaning that states are individually, in this case federally, would have to meet a certain minimum amount of renewable energy in their mix. It's the best market mechanism without subsidies to get renewable energy used, and to set up a trading scheme where if a state or a company doesn't have enough renewables, they can then buy those credits on the market if they need to, and other states who have excess can sell them to really build that market in. And then the last thing I would do right off would be to establish today a high CAFE standard, for example, the 40 miles per gallon, but to do it in a way that's good for business, to say this is the standard that will be phased in over a number of years. We're not going to back down on it, and we are going to reward innovation as opposed to rewarding the sort of laggard behavior. And those three mechanisms would dramatically change our energy patterns.
Steve Nadell?
Yeah, I agree that CAFE would actually be at the top of my list, either outright increasing the standard to 40 MPG or accelerating the 1 million barrels per day provision that's already in the bill and adding a 2 million and a 3 million barrel provision farther out. The other thing I would do is I would add a requirement that the electric and gas utilities have specific energy saving goals. Say 1% per year. So in the first year, they have to save 1% working with all of their customers, the second year, 2%, et cetera. And gradually, at the rate of 1% a year, you could really build up some very, very substantial savings.
Let me see if I can get a quick call in before we have to say goodbye. Let's go to Dr. Julio Friedman, University of Maryland.
Julio, how are
Julio,
you?
Julio, I'm sorry.
Quite okay. Thank you for taking my call.
Quickly.
There are so many things I want to talk about, but I'm only going to talk about one, which is carbon's capture and storage. Mm-hmm. That obviously the Department of Energy has taken some sort of baby steps in terms of getting things off the ground in terms of things like Futuregen and small research projects and tests and stuff like that. But basically, we can generate an awful lot of power from fossil fuel, except for things like carbon dioxide and greenhouse gas emissions as the major downside to that. There's other downsides, but that's the one we can't fix. And I was wondering both what's in the bill and what your guests think about significantly increasing activity in terms of carbon capture and storage.
Quick answer. Anybody know if there's anything in the bill for taking CO2 out of the air and sticking it back in the ground?
Well, there's quite a bit of support for sort of research steps in that, but you don't need to support it that much because the oil companies have already done it in a huge way. Chevron and others are giving Stanford $225 million, the biggest single gift to a university ever, for work in this area. And I really do think it's putting the cart before the horse. We could do these efficiency measures, we could do these cleaner production methods, and worry less about burying the CO2, which I believe could also come back to haunt us.
I've got to wrap up my guest, Daniel Kamen, professor in the Goldman School of Public Policy, professor of nuclear engineering, director of the Renewable and Appropriate Energy Laboratory, University of California at Berkeley, Stephen Nadell, executive director, the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy in Washington. Thank you both for joining us this hour.